Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge, and let's begin with an experiment. Think of something really disgusting.
Human feces, vomit, the bodies of dead animals, the bodies of dead animals that are in your food, stinky, smelly people, bad hygiene habits, dirty toilets. Is that enough? You feel sick enough?
Yes. Okay, that is pretty disgusting. And I'm sorry, I promise, I'm not trying to gross you out just for fun. There's a point here. I didn't actually show you any of those things. You didn't have to smell them or touch them or see them. But if you're like me, just thinking about them made you feel a little sick. That's the power of disgust. It's one of the most primal emotional responses, and it's so easy to elicit that I can make you feel queasy just with words. How is that even possible?
Disgust has that almost magical power to go beyond mere words and take you to another place, take you to a place of emotions, to a place of strong feelings, where you're conjuring up things that you desperately want to avoid. And the work I've been doing has been trying to provide a story to explain why all of those strange things are disgusting.
This is Valerie Curtis. She's a public health scientist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and she's part of a growing network of disgustologists, researchers who are pioneering a new science of revulsion, which turns out to be incredibly revealing. For instance, take relationships.
So when a relationship is good and strong, people are perfectly happy to share a toothbrush. But when a relationship starts to break down, it's, oh my God, his filthy shoes, his filthy socks again. Oh, the smell he's made. In fact, it's been shown by relationship counselors that this is one of the first signs of a problem in relationships. So disgust is part of this intimate relations that we have between individuals and how we negotiate our relationships between each other.
Valerie says disgust is like a light that you can shine into dirty corners, and it can help us understand things a lot better. Everything from how we vote to who we love. The only problem is, to do the research, you have to talk about things that most people don't even want to think about.
I think you have to be fairly strong-stomached. Probably the biggest outstanding issue in public health in the world today is the fact that something over a billion people still have no toilets. But yet, to try and recruit scientists to my team to work on the problem of how to get toilets to people has been a constant nightmare, because we have to face the fact that human wastes cause disease. But human wastes are contaminating, disgusting things. So people don't really want to talk about it, let alone do what some of my colleagues do, which is go down pit latrines and study the bacteria that live in them, for example. Very brave they are too, but the disgust you have to stomach to do that sort of work is powerful, visceral, and very, very hard to overcome.
You know, it's such a familiar emotion that I think this is going to seem like a stupid question, but what is disgust?
Well, it's like asking what is an emotion. And I think what we should start with is trying to understand why humans should behave in certain ways and not in others. So if you think about it, you have ancient ancestors, a long line of them going back, in fact, back to green slime, back to animals, back to simpler forms of ourselves. They all had to deal with the problem of parasites. Parasites try to hitch a ride in us. They try to make a living out of living on us and multiplying within us. And so every human being has to have strategies, and in fact, every animal has to have strategies to prevent that happening. It's very similar to fear. Every one of your ancient ancestors was probably frightened of predators. None of your ancient ancestors, when they saw a saber-toothed tiger, went, oh, what a sweet pussy, and went and petted them.
Well, because they'd have been eaten, right? Those who did died out.
Exactly. So those of our ancient ancestors who went around going, oh, boo, oh, vomit, there's some food left in that, let me eat it. What happened to them? They went extinct. So the fact is that our ancient ancestors were all squeamish. Your ancient ancestors and my ancient ancestors. And we've all inherited squeamishness from them. And that's disgust. It's a system in our brain that biases our behavior towards doing things that stopped us catching infectious diseases and getting infected by parasites.
So it's essentially hardwired, you know, it comes readily installed in us. And yet some kinds of disgust, especially with food, is so culturally specific. I mean, you know, people in one country will love Limburger cheese or fermented shark meat, and other people from other countries will recoil. But so if disgust is related to pathogen avoidance, shouldn't there be more uniformity in the kinds of things different cultures find disgusting?
Well, actually, amazingly, there is a huge amount of uniformity in what different cultures find disgusting. I always say disgust is theme and variations. There's a big theme that you find the same from in every culture that you look at. The same things occasion disgust. There's seven particular types of disgust.
Seven?
Seven, actually, that you find across cultures. So we find, first of all, products that come out of other people, things like poo, things like pus, things like vomit. We find poor hygiene disgusting. Sex is an area where we're particularly careful about who we mate with, and any signs of infection in a potential mate. Somebody who doesn't look healthy, has got dirty hair, hasn't groomed themselves, might have parasites, might be spotty. We tend to find a little bit of a turnoff. Types of food and animals we find disgusting. So animals that vector disease, like cockroaches and rats, we tend to find disgusting, and foods that have gone off. We do also find other people who look strange disgusting. It's an unpleasant reality, but it's true. Studies have shown that people who look extremely obese or people who look extremely ill, very thin, for example, tend to elicit a certain degree of disgust. And then we're disgusted by things that have come into contact with other things that are disgusting. So if I take a bite out of a sandwich, put it down again, you don't want to touch it because it's come into contact with my saliva. That's six types of disgust. Those are all parasite avoidance disgusts. But then there's the seventh one, which is moral disgust. And that's not so much about parasites, but there's an interesting story as to why things that we find immoral are also things that we find disgusting.
So it sounds like disgust evolved as primarily a protective mechanism, but there's an unpleasant side to all of this that we haven't really talked about when disgust is applied to groups of people undeservedly. I mean, some of the worst genocides in the 20th century were fueled by the language of disgust, in part. Has the research given you a better sense of how disgust can lead to discrimination?
Yeah, it has given me a very clear insight into what's going on with discrimination. So disgust is deeply interwoven with discrimination. It's a sad fact that we are very careful about our interactions with other human beings, particularly other human beings who might be outsiders, because outsiders could be the carriers of novel pathogens, novel diseases that we haven't met before that might be particularly dangerous to us. So we are innately rather careful in our interactions with strangers, and the greater the degree of distance, the more likely we are to be able to be disgusted by them. So what happens is leaders are aware of this. They know that we have this rather dark tendency within us to disparage, dislike, and be disgusted by out-group, by the people who aren't part of our in-group. And they prey on this during election campaigns, for example. They prey on it to create divisions, to create factions, to create a sense of, if you vote for me, I will protect you, you're the insider, and I will drive away the outsider, by using the rhetoric of disgust, by using the rhetoric of disease. It is no accident that during times of elections, we hear about immigration far more. We hear about foreigners far more, because what leaders are doing is getting people to vote for them by stirring up hatred and disgust of outsiders.
It's so interesting what you're saying, because I guess I have always assumed that stereotyping was at the root of prejudice. It sounds like you're saying it's in fact fueled by disgust.
There's lots of different sorts of prejudice, but there is a very strong part of our human psyche that we evolved, because we evolved in societies which were very small and clannish, where we favored in-group over out-group, and where it made sense from a disease prevention perspective to prefer people who didn't look like they were behaving oddly, because that might mean they had a disease, or because they looked strange because it might mean that they had a disease. So humans do have a certain innate desire to be clannish and to avoid the different and the difficult. But that doesn't mean we have to listen to that nowadays. I think it's very important we recognize that that is part of our psyche and that we deal with it. So, for example, the human village now is a much bigger community than it was when we evolved. We actually know people from across the planet and interact with them very closely. They become our friends. They become our local community. And we recognize much greater variety of norm nowadays because we see so many more different types of people. So prejudice is breaking down. And the answer to it is more exposure to every type of human being that there is from our in-group and different to us, because we come to then recognize that as normal and we stop feeling disgust about it.
Valerie Curtis is the director of the Hygiene Center at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and she's the author of Don't Look, Don't Touch, Don't Eat, The Science Behind Revulsion. So while disgust evolved to help early humans avoid pathogens, today it shapes everything from our reaction to strangers to voting habits, and there's a psychologist named David Pizarro who has even linked disgust to political affiliation. He told Steve Paulson that as an emotion, disgust is a researcher's dream.
You know, as a psychologist who studies emotions, you want to do experiments. And so what you often do is you bring people into the lab and you try to induce an emotion and make people feel happy or sad. And this is challenging, right? You can show them video clips. You can ask them to recall a time they were angry or happy or sad. Disgust is easy. It's really easy.
It's the magic tool for the academic researcher.
It's amazing. I mean, one picture, you know, one sentence, and sometimes even one word. I've had, in giving talks on the topic of disgust, I've had at least four or five times somebody come up to me and say, has anybody talked to you about the word moist and how disgusting that word is? And I realize it's a thing. There's like a group of people. I'm sure there's like a website dedicated to being just one word making them feel disgust.
Moist.
That's not something
I would have guessed.
I do not know why. I thought that's like what Sara Lee cakes are supposed to be. You know, I don't.
Right. I thought moist was a good thing, but
yeah, I'm sure we're grossing out like 3% of the population.
Right. So you've done this fascinating research on how disgust shapes our moral beliefs. And you've even gone further than that. You've discovered there's a connection between a person's sensitivity to disgust and their political affiliation.
Yeah. And so that finding right there was something that was accidental. We weren't looking for it. And so a few years ago, when I was trying to study disgust and its relationship to moral beliefs, we started using this tool that had been developed by other researchers that is called the Disgust Sensitivity Scale. And it basically just asks you a bunch of questions. Like, imagine that you are, you walk into a public restroom and the toilet's unflushed. How grossed out would you be? So there's a number of these questions, and you get an overall score. And at the request of another professor who asked me to insert a political orientation question, simple, how liberal, how conservative are you? I kept finding that the more disgusted people reported being, the more likely they were to say that they're conservative. And I ignored this for about three studies until I arrived at Cornell as a junior prof. And Yoel Imbar, a graduate student who started working with me, said, you know, you can't keep ignoring this. And so we documented it now a few times, and most recently in what I think is the best study to date across about 25 different countries in their native languages. We document the same sort of left-right disgust correlation.
Well, I mean, so just to be absolutely clear about this, are you saying that you can predict how conservative a person will be based on their sensitivity to disgust?
Well, you can. And by predict, we simply mean that there is a correlation. That is, the more likely you are to say that you're disgusted by a variety of things, the more likely you are to say that you're politically conservative. You can say this the other way around. The less disgusted you report being, the more liberal you are.
So basically, but if you're not really disgusted about anything, then you're going to be very liberal.
You're more likely to be liberal. And but the caveat here is that this is a modest relationship, that it's a small correlation. So when people ask me, you know, is this a good way to determine whether someone's liberal or conservative? What I always tell them is that the best way is to ask them if they're liberal or conservative. But for us, it was interesting theoretically that there is this reliable relationship. And we can go into some of the reasons why. You know, I don't think this is a fluke.
Well, let's talk about that. So why would there be a connection between sensitivity to disgust and your politics?
Good question, Steve. you can divide up, sort of slice up your emotional reactions in terms of the kind that make you avoid things and the kind that make you approach things. And so negative emotions like fear often make you stay away from dangerous things. And disgust is thought to be similar to this, except for that it deals with a different class of threats, things that would be likely to make you sickly. And so there's always a balance, right? Because we also gain a lot of advantage from being open to novelty and new experiences. So the first person to ever try a tomato unleashed the power of tomatoes upon society. and so there has to be this balance between these two drives that we have, the approach, the explore, the be creative, try new things, and the be careful, don't do something that might be dangerous if no one's ever done it.
And the politics here then, as you're saying, if you're open to new experiences, to novelty, you're more likely to be politically liberal. If you see the world as potentially full of threats, you're more likely to be conservative.
Exactly. And so once you get that explanation, it's almost the definition of conservative to want everything to stay the same and be resistant to change.
Yeah. So I want to come to this question of the link between disgust and morality. You've already said there's a connection between disgust and political orientation. And I would think there would be huge ramifications about the kinds of moral codes that a society develops, or even sort of legal rules. I mean, you know, how we think about justice. What have you found?
Yeah, it turns out that when you look at geographical regions and you separate them into those that had historically high levels of parasites in the environment and low levels of parasites in the environment, what emerges are cultures that when there are high levels of parasites, in other words, where disease is a common thing that everybody has to be worried about, those cultures tend to be more conservative. And they're more xenophobic, they're more sexually conservative, and there seems to be a class, at least, of attitudes that is directly related to what many researchers call the purity domain. Hmm. Those moral norms that are all about keeping your body pure, your group pure, in evolutionary terms, free of disease and free from the threats of catching disease from weird other people.
I mean, this raises a fascinating question, which is, I mean, should we basically try to overcome those emotions, overcome those visceral reactions of disgust to reason about things, to carefully deliberate? Because it would, I don't know, seem to be a higher stage of humanity or something like that. I mean, I'm sure you're going to say that's not realistic because we do react emotionally. But should that be the goal?
So there are people who have said, so Leon Cass, who was a bioethicist under the first Bush administration, argued famously that what you just described, using reason to arrive at all of your moral rules, is the wrong thing to do because our emotions are actually informative. He called it the wisdom of repugnance. So he said, when you feel that tinge of disgust at some practice, call it a sexual practice, in this case he was talking about human cloning, he said, there is wisdom in that response and it would behoove you to listen to it. Now, if I have an immediate disgust response and I think to myself, well, maybe I shouldn't be having this response, you now face a few challenges. One is it's hard to regulate your emotional responses. I mean, right. We can do it. There are a variety of ways in which we can do it. You know, that's what therapy
is. Well, I mean, you're
is.
Sort of like, you kind of think, okay, I shouldn't be feeling this, but I do.
I shouldn't. Exactly. Yeah.
So I want to come back to the political implications of what you're saying, because I don't think you're saying this, but I just want to check that if you really kind of rationally analyze your disgust emotions and sort of, you know, use the power of reason over emotion, then you're likely to limit that those feelings of disgust? Are you likely to become less conservative and more liberal?
You know, I think that the answer is perhaps. To the extent that conservatives are driven by a distrust of novel things, it may very well be that as you sort of limit the scope of your disgust reaction, you might find yourself accepting practices that you would not have accepted before. And then that would just sort of, by definition, make you more liberal. But there is no right answer to how much disgust one ought to feel. I mean, me personally, I think, you know, many college sophomore males, when I look at their dorm rooms, I think they ought to feel more disgust.
Yes. I can attest to that, yes.
and so perhaps I do have an opinion about that. But especially when it comes to the way we treat other human beings, I always tell my students, look, you're allowed to be opposed to gay marriage. I disagree with you, but if the only thing that's driving that is that you think it's kind of gross, then I would ask you to think about two very unattractive people having sex. I think that's pretty gross too, but it has absolutely no implications for whether I would legislate ugly marriage. So there's an extra step there that we want to be concerned with how we're treating other human beings. That is what human morality is about, and that is what the ability to reflect, I think, how that should be used to guide our emotional responses. And in many cases, make us have emotional responses in the appropriate circumstances.
Yeah. Well, this is just totally fascinating. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for talking to me about it.
Steve Paulson talking with Cornell psychologist David Pizarro. And you can hear more about David's work on his podcast, Very Bad Wizards. Coming up, would you eat insects to save the world? It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We're talking about disgust in this episode. And have you ever wondered why a dish that is a delicacy and prized in one culture is absolutely loathsome in another? I'm thinking of things like Scottish haggis or Wisconsin's lutefisk or kazumarzu, which is a kind of rotten cheese. It's really popular in Sardinia. Why are people drawn to foods like that?
People get bored with the same kinds of foods day in and day out. And you'll find situations where people are eating things that are deliberately rotten. And you think, well, why would anybody ever do that? And I believe that that sort of came about as a result of just sheer boredom. And it's a slightly different flavor. It's a very strong flavor. And if it didn't kill you, the taste became something that became a cultural lodestone.
Krista Weil is a journalist with a taste for what she calls fierce food, food that's on the challenging side, like the putrefying shark meat that's Iceland's national dish.
The hákarl, yeah, this is shark meat that, if it were eaten unprepared properly, it would make you very sick because it has a lot of urea. So somehow somebody, back in the history of time, evolved a manner of preparing this meat so that it could be eaten, which is you bury it in the beach, under the beach gravel for several months, in which time bacteria set in that ferment it or possibly rot it. There is actually a difference. But anyway, it smells very bad when it's dug up. And in order to alleviate that somewhat, it's hung to dry for another few months in a windy shack. And then it's ready to be consumed. Icelanders eat it as part of this Viking celebration that they have at the end of January, and it's consumed in tiny little cubes, innocuous-looking pink cubes, and downed with tons and tons of caraway liqueur. And, you know, it reminds everybody of the Viking ancestry, and it's a wonderful national food, but apparently nobody really likes it. The Swedish variation is rotten herring in a can called surströmming. And it's, again, it's a national dish. There's great pride attached to it. And the funny thing is you can buy it sort of in any major food or fish cellar in the autumn months, and you allow it to ferment further. So you have a can in your fridge that is literally expanding and blowing up. And finally, it gets to the point where you're really at risk of blowing out your entire fridge with surströmming. So you have to open it up, and you do so in a can of water, because I know this for a fact, the smell is so very bad. And even so, it's unbelievable when you open that thing up. Again, this is something that is consumed with a great deal of, in this case, vodka, usually Absolut for national pride's sake. I had my first surströmming in Hampstead Heath here, which is one of the largest parks in London, just to be sure that it got nowhere near our kitchen. And every dog within a mile came running over to figure out what the heck was that smelled like that.
Krista Weil is a journalist and author of a book called Fierce Food. And speaking of fierce food, imagine sitting down at a restaurant and ordering up a delicious meal of bug burgers and candied mealworms, washed down with a tall glass of cockroach milk. So maybe that sounds like the stuff of nightmares to you, but there is a growing movement working to make that standard dinner table fare in the not-too-distant future. And the idea is even catching on. Edible insects are emerging as the latest food trend. Bugs are popping up on menus in London, New York, San Francisco, and Portland. It's not just exoticism fueling the trend. With their rapid growth rates and low resource demand, insects are being touted as an environmentally friendly alternative to factory farm animals. A UN report released a few years ago said insects could even help tackle global food insecurity. Arnold Van Hoys is one of the report's authors. Raymond Tungekar caught up with him to find out more about edible insects.
Arnold, when you're proposing, I'm guessing a lot of people would find that pretty gross, maybe even revolting. So make the case for us. Why should people consume insects?
There are a lot of environmental reasons. If we look at current livestock production, and if we look to 2050, then the demand for meat will increase by about 80%. But currently, at this moment, the area with livestock is already 80% of all agricultural land. In order to meet that increasing demand, we need alternatives. Insects require about five times less land area than the current livestock species. But if you also look at, let's say, the use of fresh water, to make 1 kilogram of beef, you need about 20 to 40,000 liters of water. So that's enormous. And insects, in comparison, do much better. So there are quite some reasons to consider insects as human food and as animal feed, both of them.
But why not just recommend a plant-based diet?
Well, I completely agree. That is one of the solutions. But I think there will still be people who really like to have some meat on their plate.
Okay. What kinds of insects are you talking about for human or animal consumption?
Okay, there is a difference. If we talk about human consumption, then there is a company in the Netherlands that's also developing a factory right now, which is also able to produce tons, and that's a mealworm species. And that is already used in burgers. You can buy in a number of supermarkets in the Netherlands, you can buy burgers which are made out of that mealworm species.
Really? That's already on the market in the Netherlands? Mealworm
already,
burgers?
Yeah. Yeah, I can go here to the supermarket and buy one. Yeah.
How do they taste?
Well, I think they should do a bit more research on making it more tasty. they are working on it. Hmm. But I think that can be done because I've tasted, let's say, meatballs in which they replaced the meat by mealworms. And those were extremely tasty, even in blind tests given to let's say, random people.
Hmm. So nutritionally, how do insects compare with other foods that are typically eaten in the West?
Yeah, first of all, we have about 2,000 species of insects that are eaten all over the world.
Wow.
So, of course, it's very difficult to generalize. But let me make some generalizations. I would say protein content is more or less similar to the common meat products. And what is interesting, but that's especially for the tropical world, is that insects like crickets, palm weevils, Mopana caterpillar, they're quite rich in iron and zinc. And that's important because, let's say, a quarter of the world population, especially children and women, they have an iron deficiency. So that could really contribute to alleviating those deficiencies.
Hmm. So, I mean, it's obvious that this is a cause that you're very much committed to. I'm just wondering, though, how did you get here? Like, how did you actually become an advocate for insect
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, I was. I'm a tropical entomologist, so I worked 3 years in Niger, in a Sahelian country in Africa, and I went to the plant protection service and I asked them about edible insects, and they told me that women are making more money by selling the grasshoppers they collect from their millet than by selling their millet. Huh. And that was really an eye-opener for me. And I thought, how could I have been so stupid during the 3 years I was working in Niger and never observed this? Well, there is a logical explanation. People in tropical countries don't talk about it because they know that we consider it a primitive behavior, so they don't talk to you about it. And it was only when I specifically asked that they told me this. So that was really an eye-opener for me. And then that's when I became interested, really, in this this food culture.
So I've only eaten insects. I can probably count all the times I've had insects on one hand. And there's one time in particular that stands out for me. And it was, I went to my favorite Thai restaurant, and I ordered some silkworms off the menu. And after two or three bites, I couldn't get over this visceral disgust reaction. And I'm probably not alone in kind of reacting that way. So I guess, how do you expect people to overcome that visceral disgust feeling, that this idea that insects are repulsive or dirty somehow?
Yeah, I understand your reaction of the silkworm. I had the same experience. First of all, let's say one of the strategies is to organize bug banquets.
What is a bug banquet?
A bug banquet is just that you prepare snacks with insects for people. Another strategy is to disguise the insect into burgers or nuggets or schnitzels or meatballs so people don't recognize them anymore. That's another strategy. And I think another strategy, and that's what we used as well in our cookbook, we interviewed important people like, let's say, Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the United Nations. We interviewed him about edible insects. And, well,
really?
He said
he's a supporter?
He's a supporter, absolutely.
Huh, that's fascinating.
And he just said, well, it's just a matter of educating the public. So.
So why do you think it's taken so long for insects to catch on? I mean, I'm thinking of something like lobster, which, I mean, to me, looks like a giant insect, yet it's considered a delicacy.
Yeah. If you look at the last 5 years, there has been a tremendous increase in interest in edible insects. For our cookbook, we also interviewed René Redzepi. You may know him. He is the chef of Noma, which
considered
has been declared
to be the best restaurant in the world.
Yeah, 4 times it has been declared the best restaurant in the world. And he also says, you know, that we look down on people who eat insects is almost a racistic attitude. You know, those people are learning us, you know, how to enjoy insects just as a meal. And so if you go to his restaurant, you will get insects to eat.
Huh. Can you recall the most delicious insect dish that you've ever had?
Yeah. In fact, there are 2 or 3. I was at the conference and somebody on edible insects and somebody brought some locusts from the Sahelian region and they were deep fried with quite some pepper in it. And I found it really delicious. I also had grasshoppers in Thailand that was at a local market, and they were presented as snacks. So I ate those, and they were also delicious. But I forgot to ask the recipe because it was, yeah, that was a pity.
Tropical entomologist Arnold Van Hoys is a co-author of the UN report Edible Insects, Future Prospects for Food and Food Security. Raymond Tungekar talked with him. Coming up, a bat biologist explores his fascination with a much reviled winged mammal. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
Hi, I'm Gemma Files, the author of Experimental Film, available right now from Cheezine Publications. And the dangerous idea I'd like to talk about today is the concept of horror as comfort food. By which I mean, and I get asked this a lot as a horror author, how can spending all your time playing out negative scenarios in fiction help you live a more positive life? I know for myself that Wes Craven's observation about horror being far more comforting than real life because it at least has set rules makes a lot of sense to me. By allowing myself to think my way through all the worst things that could potentially happen to me or my loved ones in a fictional space, I feel as though I can cultivate at least a modicum of control in the face of the truly uncontrollable. It also supports my general thesis that horror, far from being a narrow niche market, actually involves bedrock human experiences and impulses, the awful mysteries that everyone will eventually be confronted by. Why not take an informed approach to things like mortality and loss, rather than allow them to spring out on you without warning? By consuming horror, I guarantee that nothing is ever off the table for me to contemplate. I'm thus able to meet things head on, with a well-adjusted sense of my own capabilities, even a type of black humor, which allows me to emerge from sudden disasters, bent and bruised, but hopefully never broken. I have a son, and my son has special needs. He's on the autism spectrum. And I have to say that I believe that my background in horror allowed me to accept that and contemplate both the worst and the best things that could happen in his life with a little more equanimity than a person who hadn't already been used to playing those things out in their head. That's what I believe. It's potentially possible that other people have other things that they rely on. Religion, perhaps. My husband's uncle is the priest who married us, and his father is a deacon, and he's a Catholic, but you know, I'm not. So horror is my thing. Horror is my church. And I truly believe that it's because I'm already used to thinking about things like, well, what if my son gets hit by a car? What if he gets a horrible disease? What if a demon comes into his mouth when he's yawning too wide? Whatever. That when something does pop up, when, for example, your father comes from Australia and says, you know, Cal isn't really responding the way that all the other kids of his age I've seen respond to stimulus, respond to other people. Yeah, you have your moment of, Dad, what the hell do you know? But then after that, you let yourself cry and you get on with it. It's not the worst thing that could happen. Very little is the worst thing that could happen.
Writer Gemma Files with her dangerous idea. And you can find more dangerous ideas on our website at ttbook.org. We've been talking about disgust in this episode. And there are certain animals that many people just find gross. Rats, cockroaches, and bats. If you've ever woken up at night to find a bat swooping around your bedroom, as I have, then you know there is something about them that can just seem repulsive. And that's unfair, because bats fill a crucial biological niche. They eat mosquitoes, they pollinate flowers, they do a lot of good. And now they're endangered. Merlin Tuttle is a biologist and the founder of Bat Conservation International. He's also the Indiana Jones of the bat world. He's gone everywhere to find rare species, crawled into caves, swum through crocodile-infested rivers, stared down lions and king cobras and dangerous bandits. Does sound like a movie, doesn't it? Tuttle now has a memoir out about his adventures. It's called The Secret Lives of Bats. He told Steve Paulson that he'll do just about anything to find them.
Well, I've had certainly plenty of experiences getting caught in tight places and roping off 100-foot cliffs in caves in search of bats, but you don't necessarily have to go in caves to find bats. There are bats that live in all kinds of incredible places. One kind that I'll be studying within the next 3 weeks burrows into large termite nests in the tropics and hollows out a cavity in the termite nest and lives with the termites. 2 years ago, I was in Borneo photographing bats that live in pitcher plants. Pitcher plants traditionally are famous for eating whatever comes right. inside.
Wait, so the bats live in the plant?
Yeah. There's a species of bat that actually lives in pitcher plants, and the pitcher plants have evolutionarily figured out that it's much more energetically cost-effective to feed on bat guano that comes every day instead of eating the bat and then going hungry for a long time.
Wow, amazing.
There are even bats that live in colonial spider webs. There are bats that live in crocodile burrows. There are bats live in all kinds of places.
And they come in all sizes as well. I mean, there are tiny bats. The bumblebee bat, how big is it? Or how small, I should say?
Bumblebee bat weighs about a third less than a penny. I was photographing them just 2 years ago. There are also giant flying foxes, especially out in the Pacific Islands, that have up to 6-foot wingspans. And bats are incredibly intelligent. They form long-term friendships. They adopt orphans. They're the longest-lived mammals by far for their size.
How long do they live?
Some small bats have been found to live over 40 years, and bats don't get cancer or arthritis either.
Now, over the course of your career, you seem to have worn two hats. I mean, you were obviously a very public advocate for bats. You're also a biologist, and you have traveled around the world studying bats. And to do this, you have to go into a lot of very remote places where people don't normally go, like caves, which can be hard to explore, remote wilderness areas. And all of this can get pretty dangerous. I mean, not because of the bats, but because of the environments you're going into.
Yeah. For all the supposed dangers of being around bats, I have handled hundreds of species, have been surrounded by millions at a time for days on end in caves. I'm still waiting for the first bat to ever attack me or give me a disease or in any way harm me. Yet, on the other hand, I've nearly been killed multiple times by people, dogs, elephants, lions, tigers, king cobras. Bats are certainly not the worst of my worries.
Okay, well, let's talk about a few of these adventures that you've had. I mean, it's kind of remarkable hearing about some of the stuff that you've been through. I mean, for instance, you were, once surrounded by bandits in Africa?
Yes, in fact, a good friend of mine who I was with just yesterday, we'd gone to Africa to see if there were bats that homed in on frog calls in Africa. And we'd just finished recording some frog calls out in a marshy area. We'd gotten back in our Land Rover and were just ready to drive off when all of a sudden we looked out and found ourselves surrounded by about a dozen bandits. Fortunately, we had an assistant who had actually been trained by the Israeli Mossad in anti-guerrilla warfare, and he was absolutely phenomenal at dealing with crisis situations. Well, first he told Mike Ryan, my colleague who was behind the steering wheel, keep the engine running and be ready to do exactly what I say. He spoke a lot of languages and he had overheard them plotting to kill us. He totally amazed them when he jumped out right into them. You know, they had us surrounded, but everybody was so curious to see this idiot who would jump out in front of all of them. Instead of having us surrounded, the rest of them then came to that side to see him. When he realized they were just about to attack, he made a fake lunge at the leader, and that took them all by such surprise that they all, you know, just kind of automatically jumped back a step or two. And while they were off balance, he dived back into the Land Rover. He'd left the door open behind him, grabbed a big blaster spotlight, yelled at Mike to drive like hell, shone the light out the window into the bandit's eyes, and we were able to escape because now he had them all on one side. But I've actually got photographs of where spears hit the back of the Land Rover as we were leaving.
Wow. So you've had these encounters with people who were rather dangerous. You've also had some encounters with animals. There's one other story I have to ask you about. And you were in Peru,
and looking for some very rare kind of bat. And you end up, climbing down a cliff, wading through a river, climbing into a cave. Tell me what happened there.
I had just recovered from paratyphoid, which I'd contracted while I was out in the middle of nowhere, living with Compa Indians while studying bats. And first day I felt like I could get up and move around a little bit. This guy who I knew to be a great-great-grandfather offered to show me a cave that had supposedly all kinds of bats in it. Of course, a Batman can't resist hearing about a cave that has all kinds of bats in it. So we hiked for miles, and the Indians don't have good ways of telling you how much further it is. You ask them how far, and they'll say, one more hill, two more streams. And you have no idea how far apart those are. Well, we finally got to where the cave was. The cave turned out that it was at least 100 feet below us. We came out on top of a big cliff. It's one of the most beautiful Edenic sights I ever saw in my life. 100-foot or so waterfall, ferns, and all kinds of tropical lianas and constant rainbows. It was really beautiful, but then all of a sudden this guy, without any hesitancy, starts climbing down liana vines to go down a 100-foot cliff. And he looks a little surprised that we're not quickly, my brother and I aren't quickly following him. So we start climbing down the vines, and we'd get down to a ledge, and we'd climb along the ledge a while, find some more vines, and go down some more. Well, when we got to the bottom, it turned out that you couldn't get to the cave without swimming across a pond. I could see the tracks of an anaconda. We're not talking about a small snake. We're talking about a snake that could eat a person. Right. There were piranha. There were electric eels. They're down on the bottom, so if you keep your feet well off the bottom, you're probably not going to get shocked by one. But we nearly drowned trying to keep our headlights and things above water and keep our feet high while we swam across the pond. Then I get to the cave entrance, and it actually was one of the only times that the Indians were wrong about anything. It didn't have any bats in it. It had oil birds, and the oil birds had left a very heavy coating of guano that was just the most putrid, rotting material floating in water at the entrance. We'd taken off our clothes to swim across the pond, and my brother and the Indian were going to hold a mist net out in front of the cave on poles while I chased some bats out to get caught. But then to get in, got past the guano and breathed a sigh of relief. Then the cave got narrower and narrower, and finally I'm pinned in with just my arms up ahead of my, in front of me, and just as I'm getting really nervous about how narrow it is and whether I can back out if I have to, I come to a dead end. So I'm lying there saying, okay, don't panic. You got plenty of time. There's got to be a way of wriggling backwards out of this. Before starting to do that, I kind of turned my head back and tried to look back a little bit. What I hadn't noticed was that not more than just a few inches above my bare back, the ceiling of this passage was covered in scorpions. Well, you can imagine I just about wore a groove in the floor getting back out.
The adventures of a bat biologist. Are there still scientific mysteries about bats? Are there
yes,
still things we don't know?
Absolutely.
Do we know how bats migrate? I mean, how they find out where they're going to go?
Not yet. Several species migrate up to 1,000 miles or more south for winter. Other species migrate in all directions. Some migrate north, some east, west, some south to get to a particular abandoned mine or an old cave that has the right conditions to hibernate in.
So how do they find their way? What do you think?
Well, bats are very good communicators, and it's my belief that young bats have to learn from older bats. I have never found young gray bats migrating outside the company of adults. mother gray bats migrate well ahead of the young, leave the young behind in the fall. And it seems to be the adult males that actually show the young bats how to find the way. I'm amazed when I realize that bat echolocation probably doesn't extend more than 30 feet or so in front of them. They're having to use some pretty incredible navigational skills to cope with the fact that we change the countryside every year, put in highways, put in fields, chop forests, do things that just must change dramatically what it looks like to migrate across. And yet these bats, year after year, figure out where they should go.
Merlin Tuttle is a bat biologist and also clearly indestructible. He's the founder of Bat Conservation International, and he talked with Steve Paulson about his book, The Secret Lives of Bats, My Adventures with the World's Most Misunderstood Mammals. That's it for this hour, but there is always more in our podcast feed. To subscribe, look us up on iTunes, Stitcher, or any other podcasting app. That way you'll never miss another show. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Charles Monroe Kane, Shannon Henry Kleiber, Mark Rickers, and Halima Shah. Joe Hartke is our sound designer and technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strange Champs. Thanks for spending time with us today.